how did California become the poster child for housing scarcity? Well, there are a lot of reasons, but a big part of it is a group of people and organizations that we refer to somewhat nefariously as NIMBYs. We're going to talk about NIMBYs today and NIMBYism. This is the latest episode of Independent Conversations. And for this discussion of housing and NIMBYism in California, I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, Christopher Carlton, who is our research fellow in housing and homelessness here at Independent Institute. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you.
Glad to have you. Thank you for all the work you've done in this area. And you bring to it a lot of preparation, too. For example, you've earned your PhD in history at the University of Florida. You are a major contributor to the book, upcoming research paper, called Beyond Homeless, Good Intentions, Bad Outcomes, Transformative Solutions. And you've been published in a lot of interesting places, including the San Francisco Chronicle. The Chronicle seems to kind of like you, Chris. I've noticed that in recent months. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
So you give sometimes a somewhat unorthodox, at least especially here in Northern California, an unorthodox perspective on some of these public policy problems and their history. Today, as I said, housing and NIMBYism. So just as a reminder to our friends, we are together at Independent Institute in Oakland, California. We come to you regularly under the general heading of Independent Conversations when we have a topic we want to focus on and an expert to speak to. So here we go, Chris Carlton. California is the poster child for housing scarcity. And we're talking about NIMBYs. Most people know what that refers to, but would you give us a brief reminder?
Sure. So NIMBY stands for Not in My Backyard, and it refers to individuals and groups that through political activism and legal activity block housing developments. It can apply to things other than housing. In fact, a lot of the original NIMBY contests were for projects against like industrial developments and prisons and things like that. But primarily, especially in California, it's used to block housing developments.
And we're not just talking about NIMBYs in a very totally vague and general sense. I mean, no doubt there are thousands of people in California and elsewhere who have the NIMBY mindset, but you're also focusing on specific organizations and even individuals. Can you just give us like a handful? What organizations have perpetuated a NIMBY approach to stuff?
So a big culprit in this would be the Sierra Club, an environmental group that will oppose housing in cities because they don't want the density, it creates pollution. They'll oppose housing in suburbs because they don't want, you know, more traffic and they don't want urban sprawl. They'll oppose housing in the countryside because they want to preserve farmland. They just oppose housing no matter where you propose to put it.
They oppose housing in the valley floor because it's agricultural. They oppose housing in the hillside because, well, I don't know why they oppose it there too.
Yeah, they'll find a reason. Another one would be Livable California is an organization that's more concerned with neighborhood character and neighborhood preservation, right? And so these are usually the two justifications, environmentalism and neighborhood character that we have to preserve. And they work together to block housing. But then you also have individuals, I think I mentioned a lawyer named Jeffrey Carr, I believe his name was, who has single-handedly blocked numerous developments. He's gotten reductions in the size of apartment buildings. He's got some to be canceled completely. And this is just one guy acting alone. So NIMBY is a broad umbrella category. It's not an organized movement in that sense, but it's small, decentralized organizations at times and individuals.
And it certainly does refer to a deeply ingrained reflex in California. That is to say, if there's going to be new development, something's got to be wrong with it.
It's rooted in the culture.
Yeah, it is rooted in the culture. And yet, at the same time, the culture nowadays in our era certainly is characterized by thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who share this complaint that California housing is just too expensive and there's not enough of it. And the people at the low end of the spectrum, they can't afford housing because nobody's building cheap housing. And the homelessness crisis is exacerbated by the housing scarcity and the expense of housing in California. So on the one hand, there's this reflex against development. And on the other hand, there's this great concern about housing costs and even homelessness. And so we're kind of trying to bring together these two concerns to see if we can make sense of it. And you've done a better job of pretty much anybody I've seen. We are now speaking of specifically this wonderful work that Chris Carlson has done in figuring this out by publishing this wonderful work, which I'm going to show you the picture of right now. Here it is. This is the cover of our latest California Golden Fleece Award, not in anybody's backyard, how NIMBY activism worsens California's housing crisis, by Christopher Carlson. And this is, of course, available on our website, independent.org, here from Independent Institute. So all the stuff we're talking about, you can look at in depth in this interesting report available to anybody. Let me just dive into a little bit of the first part of it. I mean, the thing is really well organized, Chris, because, you know, you've got the history of the problem. You've got the tactics that are used by NIMBYs. You've got the consequences of those tactics. And then you actually have solutions that you propose. But the history part is what really got me. I mean, this has been going on a long time. And what you chronicle here in this history section is the way that concerns about residential development and development generally have morphed. So you reach back into the mid-1960s to what was really a very, very unfortunate era in planning and in urban and suburban development, namely the effort to demolish bad areas and replace them with good stuff. This was a big deal back in the 60s. To be clear, it wasn't the free market that was pushing the demolition of neighborhoods back in the 60s. It was government planners.
Yeah, there's a book on this called The Federal Bulldozer.
Yeah. And this happened in many states. I mean, some of the most famous ones are, in, as I recall, that awful image of the Pruitt-Igoe complex in St. Louis, Missouri, which was detonated and collapsed, destroying and eventually had to be destroyed because it was a failure. But it had previously replaced thriving African-American neighborhoods in parts of St. Louis.
And speaking of St. Louis, the famous arch was built on land that was acquired through eminent domain in the destruction of affordable housing for African-American communities as well. It's a very infamous example of that.
So you kind of show us how back in, starting in the 1960s, there was a very, very understandable and even morally and socially justified resistance to this kind of pushed development that was going on. Give us a little more color about what people were reacting against back then.
Sure. So the policy that you're referring to is called urban renewal. It was originally called slum clearance, but I think under Johnson, or Truman, one of them, they said, let's not call it slum clearance anymore. Let's call it urban renewal. So the policy actually dates back. It originated with FDR as a slum clearance program, but it really picked up steam after World War II. And it kind of peaked in the 1960s. That was its apex. And the policy, at least rhetorically, was we're going to tear down the slums, these low-quality, dilapidated apartments, and we're going to replace them with nicer apartments that the people living in these dilapidated ones now could enjoy. But what really happened was the policy said you cannot build more than one apartment for each one destroyed. So they actually set a policy saying you cannot build more homes than you're destroying. And they actually built less. A lot of times, as we've already mentioned, they weren't even building apartments. They were building monuments like the St. Louis Arch. They were building commercial developments, right? This was early gentrification. But the distinction between this and most modern gentrification projects is that they were using eminent domain, right? The government, the government's ability to seize property from civilians against their will, essentially. They were using eminent domain to seize this property and have it destroyed and then basically hand it to some crony developers that were politically connected that they could make money off of because they wanted to build tax revenue. And so that was the goal. And so what happened is hundreds of thousands of low-income families were displaced. This disproportionately affected the African-American community, though it was not exclusive to them, but it displaced hundreds of thousands of low-income families. And it is one of the major developments that led to the modern homelessness crisis, where we see these like tent encampments and things like this on the street. That was something you didn't really start seeing until the late 70s. Before then, what we called the homeless were people who lived in these single-room occupancy hotels. They didn't have a family address or family connections, but they were living under a roof in most cases.
Yeah, it wasn't, with other people nearby them.
Exactly. But these were the buildings that were predominantly targeted and destroyed, and so that pushed a lot of people onto the streets. So in reaction to this, a woman named Jane Jacobs, who was, I think, well-intentioned but economically ignorant, started a community planning movement. And the idea was, we need to stop this destructive action of urban renewal, and so we need to do this by having bottom-up instead of top-down city planning. We need bottom-up city planning that is more democratic and involves the citizenry. And the idea was to block these destructive projects of urban renewal.
Yeah, so far so good.
Right, so far so good. But Jane Jacobs was kind of economically ignorant. She advocated building height restrictions because she noticed that lower, like more affordable apartments were on the ground floor of buildings. And so she thought that if we limit building height requirements, you know, housing was going to become cheaper, which is just very, very ignorant.
ignorant because it limits the supply. And if you limit the supply, the price goes up.
Right, exactly. And so she was well-intentioned, but not very economically sound. And her movement spread, as it spread to middle-class groups where they started organizing, then the middle class started agitating not to stop the destruction of the slums, so-called, but to preserve the status quo. Right. And so the first thing that they opposed the construction of would be highways. So
right.
We had highway protests, and then this would evolve into other things and manifest in organized groups for the NIMBY. So that was one element of the history that kind of led to modern NIMBYism.
Yeah, that's pretty fascinating because, you know, in the two primary instances that we've been talking about so far were the demolition of old neighborhoods at the behest of government urban planners, and then the demolition of neighborhoods for the sake of freeways and big highways, again, at the behest of government planners. In neither case were we talking about the big, bad capitalist developers. It was actually governmental initiative that caused the destruction, and people resisted it, and I kind of see why, but it morphed and the situation changed. By the 1970s, it was no longer trying to preserve viable but messy neighborhoods where poorer people live, and instead became trying to preserve against all development. And it kind of morphed from being against governmentally imposed destruction to any kind of even privately led residential development.
Right.
You mentioned environmentalism as a phase in this process, you recite how in 1972 California voters established the Coastal Zone Conservation Commission, for short the Coastal Commission. It was called Proposition 20 at the time. I was actually kind of coming of age politically in California at the time, and I literally, you're going to be surprised at this, Chris, but I literally went door to door in Santa Cruz County against Prop 20 in 1972.
You were doing the Lord's work, Graham.
Well, I thought I was, yeah. Because what got to me is that it just seemed like confiscation of private property, and I didn't understand. But then I learned a little something. What I'm about to say is not statistically significant and is wholly anecdotal, but I will tell you this, that in 1972, when I was a young teen, I was going door to door against Prop 20 at the Coastal Zone Commission. I noticed that the people who talked to me, who literally had property right on the coast or on the edge of the cliff overlooking the ocean, they were almost uniformly in favor of Prop 20. And the people who lived on suburbs further in, who were not on the coast, were much more open to my argument about confiscation and so forth. So I thought that was weird. I would have thought that the people whose property was getting confiscated would have opposed Prop 20, but actually they were in favor of it. And then I think I began to figure out why, but I think your analysis tells us why coastal property owners would have favored this restriction.
Because it prevented new development.
And therefore upped the value of their property holdings. Yeah.
Right.
And that,
by the way, I talk about this briefly in the report as well, but it's known as the home voter hypothesis. And so there was an economist, William Fischel, I never know how to pronounce his last name, but he came up with a theory that said if you actually look at the data, the strongest explanatory variable for why people oppose new development is to preserve the value of their homes. And this is really important to understand with NIMBYism, because obviously people who aren't homeowners are more likely to be YIMBYs. Young people that are having trouble buying a house are more likely to be YIMBYs, but they don't have political representation in these areas. Homeowners do. If you're trying to move into a city, you're not politically represented, but the people who already live there are. So it's a mechanism built in to favor the people who oppose new development and want to preserve the value of their homes.
Another major development in the 70s was the California Environmental Quality Act, CEQA. How did that fit into this?
Well, originally, it the way the law was drafted probably wouldn't have done much, but there was a court case, the Friends of Mammoth case is what it's known as, that took place in 1972, I believe, the year after the law was signed. And the ruling, the judge ruled that the Environmental Quality Act, which was only supposed to apply to public projects, what he ruled was that if you had a discretionary permit in the project, which California has these for almost every project now, they're very, very common in California, then that meant that it was public in the eyes of the law. So it basically expanded CEQA's requirements to almost every private project in California. And so it gave this incredible mechanism for people who wanted to oppose development to delay and block the development by threatening or levying environmental lawsuits, by appealing permits on environmental grounds, right? They can do this in San Francisco. They can do this even after the permit's been issued. They can appeal a permit afterwards and possibly have it revoked, which does happen occasionally. And CEQA has just become a weapon of NIMBYs, the biggest weapon of NIMBYs. Even more modern tactics like historic preservation and preservation of tribal lands, those all fall under CEQA. They're all, you know, which is odd. It's not environmental in the original sense of the word, but those all still fall under CEQA. So it's just become this catch-all weapon that NIMBYs can use to block development.
Yeah, it's a pretty all-purpose weapon. The concern for preserving the environment, of course, is widely appreciated by people and approved by people, but it kind of got wrapped up into simple anti-growth. You mentioned Paul Ehrlich at one point in your discussion. How did the anti-growth thing and the environmental thing coalesce?
Right. So the three elements that kind of came together in the 60s and 70s would be the community planning movement, the environmentalist movement, and then the anti-growth movement. And this kind of merged those two ideas, right? The community planning was the political means of getting this stuff done, like pressuring politicians or community planners to move in a certain direction. Environmentalism was the pretext to block development. We gotta save endangered species and preserve open space and things like this. And then the anti-growth movement was very related. So Paul Ehrlich published this famous but fallacious book called The Population Bomb that was basically just resurrecting the old Malthusian dilemma from the 18th century. It's you know, for people that, you know, follow the Marvel movies, this was Thanos's big plan in Infinity Wars, is the population is growing too much and resources are too constrained. And so, you know, the best thing we could do is reduce the population. It's literally the plot of Infinity War, right? And so it's completely fallacious. What we've shown is that innovation, like technological innovation, has consistently overcame whatever resources constraints that people like Malthus and Ehrlich predict. And these apocalyptic ideas never come to pass, but the damage was done, right? It made people very afraid of population growth. And the reaction to that was in the 80s, between environmentalism, community planning, and anti-growth ideology, is in the 80s, you started passing a lot of anti-growth regulation. So at this time, it wasn't heavily NIMBY activists protesting development. It was lobbying for new zoning rules and things like this that would limit the amount of permits. That was a direct way of controlling population growth. When courts said No, that's not okay. They would say, okay, well, we're just going to limit utilities connections. We're not going to let you have water hookups, which does the same thing. Or we're going to do, pass these minimum lot sizes of like an acre or more, where it's like you have to have an acre, which is huge for a house.
It's huge.
Right?
And wealthy people love that, because that means that they're going to have, nobody else can come in who's less wealthy than they, because you can't afford to buy a whole acre.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's big. I grew up on half an acre and we could play football in my front yard.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's like that's a lot of land for a single house. They have some areas where it's 60 acre minimum lot sizes to preserve farmland. So and there's just a litany of different parking requirements, a litany of different zoning rules. A lot of the significant zoning rules we have today are a product of this anti-growth movement in the 80s. And so after they passed these ballot measures in the 80s, then in the 90s, you started seeing a lot more organized NIMBYism, where they would challenge permits, sue under environmental law, and protest and things like this.
You mentioned at one point that in the 1970s and 80s, there were 357 anti-growth land use policies put on local ballots in California, and that most of them, the vast majority of them, were between 1986 and 1989. That was a real high point of anti-growth. Well, I don't know if it's a high point. It rose to a new plateau of fervor of anti-growth. Another thing that I was struck by is you mentioned that among the tactics used by anti-growth people was to get the federal government to purchase and control land. And that was very interesting to me, because you pointed out that the San Francisco Chronicle 3 years ago noted, demonstrated that the federal government owns nearly half the land in California. That's a stunning statistic. So why was federal government takeover of land desirable from this anti-growth environmentalist NIMBY point of view?
Well, it is worth noting, before getting into some of the changes there, that in the Western United States, federal ownership of land is much more common. They own like more than 80% of land in Nevada, I believe. So that's something that was already in place that goes back to the 19th century in the territories. But it did expand federal ownership under this NIMBYism. A lot of times it was through a national park movements. And this was really interesting, because you had people lobbying to have the federal government acquire land to make it natural parks, to preserve it so that people could enjoy the nature. But then once the federal government acquired the land and established it as a natural park, then they switched tunes and they said, oh, we don't want to preserve it for people to enjoy it. We want to protect it from visitors. So we want to keep people out. So then they opposed like building roadways into it or developing the parks so people could actually go and enjoy them. And you mentioned earlier, people kind of like in the coastal zone kind of supporting something that you thought was against their interests. And you had an example of this as well, because cattle ranchers supported this movement as well, because they thought it was going to protect the land that they used for their cattle from encroachment from developers. But in fact, it ended up displacing them. There's very little cattle ranching going on in these areas anymore. So there are numerous examples of people kind of supporting policies that end up kind of working against their interests down the road in practice.
Case in point, Point Reyes National Seashore, north of San Francisco. Beautiful, beautiful land. I understand why people would want to make it into a national park. And actually, there's a personal angle here. My grandfather and grandmother owned a big dairy ranch in Olema, which is on part of that land. And in 1962, it was confiscated by eminent domain. And my grandfather was bitter for years that the federal government had stolen his land for way, way below market. Well, he said anyway, it was way, way below market value.
Well, and that's common with eminent domain. There's a story, I didn't write about it in this NIMBY report, but I it's in a manuscript I'm working on in the history of homelessness on the urban renewal section, where it was like in a African-American area, I don't remember what city, but it was California. There was a guy who owned a bowling alley, like a black entrepreneur owned a bowling alley. And what they did to acquire his bowling alley is they first drove away everybody who lived there under urban renewal. They would seize the property from the owners. And this reduced the value of his bowling alley because they drove away his customer base. And so they paid him the market rate after their destructive act that lowered the value.
Oh, man.
And so and this is a common story under eminent domain.
Right,
it's the government manipulating things to lower market value so they can say, hey, we paid the market value. Yeah, after you destroyed the market value, right?
Right,
so this
is
absolutely theft. And one other thing I wanted to mention on the federal the federal parks movement is one of the reasons it was appealing to go to the federal government for this is because it allowed these people to outsource the cost of their activism to taxpayers in other states, right? Because you could have gone to the state and said, let's just make it a state park, but then it's California taxpayers, right? So it's the federal tax dollars are now paying for this NIMBY activism, essentially.
I want to get to some of the consequences of all this stuff, but let's touch on maybe one or two of the other tactics that we might not have mentioned or some specific examples. So for example, you mentioned in here in the town of Woodside, which is one of the classiest, you know, Silicon Valley suburbs, it decided to declare itself a national mountain lion sanctuary so that it would get around a law which would have allowed people to build duplexes on single family homes. So Woodside, a mountain lion sanctuary? Really?
Yeah, the whole town. This is one of the most infamous examples of NIMBYism because it was the town not designating an area as a mountain lion sanctuary, but declaring the entire town a mountain lion sanctuary. It was so absurd. Gavin Newsom criticized it. It came under criticism from a lot of Democrat politicians in California. I think that the courts, I believe, threw this out, said, no, you can't do that, but they're still fighting for it. So I think this is still going on, last I heard. But yeah, it was just such an absurd, extreme example of an effort just to block housing development.
And then there's the lady with the zucchini in Berkeley.
Zucchini lady, she's often referred.
Tell us about the zucchini lady, Chris.
So the zucchini lady, she kind of went locally viral because you can actually find the video on YouTube of her doing this. But she went to a planning meeting where people would show up. Right. This is the relic of the community planning movement is people go to these planning meetings to protest a development. So that's Jane Jacobs' legacy. And she brought a zucchini with her because they were trying to build like a small apartment complex near her house. And she said, this zucchini only exists because I don't have a two-story building blocking the sun from my backyard. And it's like, it's again, such an absurd, this is pollution, right? It's shade pollution, essentially. Everything's pollution. Under NIMBYism, you know, so it was just another absurd case of somebody blocking development on a ridiculous grounds.
Yeah, kind of remarkable. Successful. And then there was this, you mentioned the author, Jane Morris, who published the NIMBY handbook. It didn't sell a lot of copies, but boy, it influenced a lot of people. And you give us some quotes where this NIMBY handbook tells people, you know, go to public hearings, pregnant women should come and speak of their unborn children. Gardeners should bring in vegetables. Religious people should talk about God. Patriots should recite the Star-Spangled Banner and talk about how mom and apple pie families will not stand for having an inappropriate project rammed down their throats. Stop development. Stop the developers. Don't let people build residential housing. Fast forward to our era. Everyone says, there's not enough housing. Housing is too expensive. The homeless can't find places to live. People are schizophrenic. So some of the consequences. Talk a little more about that.
Well, the most immediate consequences is high housing costs, right? And California has the second highest housing costs in the nation after Hawaii, which has very similar problems, both in terms of policy and wildfires destroying a lot of homes in recent times. So very, very high. I mean, bordering on $1 million median home price. In some areas, it's already above $1 million. San Jose, it's above $1 million. Right. So high housing costs are the most immediate consequences. But of course, there are many other consequences because housing is such a significant portion of people's budget. It takes up so much of their annual income. Right. That's also money that's not there for other things. So it affects your economy. If you're a small business owner in this area, right, you own a restaurant or something, like high housing costs lower your business. People don't have as much money to go eat out. The cost of housing correlates with higher rates of homelessness, as you said. It exacerbates the homelessness crisis. More people living on the streets, more people passing through these systems. And then all of the services that the government provides to help people in this situation draw tax dollars that lead to high tax rates, right? And so it just creates this vicious cycle. Housing is the basis for so many tax and spend policies that are just unsustainable, and they cramp the economy, right? Because it's such a big expense for people, right? So there's all kinds of cascading consequences of this.
But people don't trace from effect back to cause. That's what's going on.
Often they don't. Yeah. So one example I talk about in here briefly and is really important to understand is a lot of NIMBYs are low-income people who are scared that some new development will raise the cost of rent for them. And the evidence shows that this isn't true. And it seems to trace back to urban renewal where it would have this effect because the new developments followed the destruction of homes and never matched the amount of homes destroyed, right? And so this has kind of led to this ongoing, like perennial misconception among a lot of people that new development without the eminent domain, without the destruction of existing property, will just make their rents go up. And all of the evidence, you know, in economics shows that this isn't true. The studies consistently show that building more housing for any income level will lower the rents of housing or lower the cost of housing at every income level. But this is not common knowledge. And a lot of this, again, it's just because people remember urban renewal. They remember this stuff and they're not making the distinction between with and without eminent domain.
Yeah, exactly. And they're not making distinction between government-initiated construction or destruction on the one hand, and then just private developers who see a way to make some money and build residential housing that people want. Those are two very, very different things. So these consequences, people just don't want to really digest what's going on. Looking now across the country to New York City, it's a good reminder of some of these problems. So the Democratic Socialists of America candidate Zoran Mamdani is a big proponent of rent controls and price controls on rent and housing and so forth in New York. But I think based on what you just said, rent controls, they only lower the rent for the people who are lucky to get the special thing, but they raise the rent for others. How do price controls raise the rent? That's what people don't get.
Well, they limit supply, right? Developers don't want to build apartments that are not subject to market prices, right? Because they can't guarantee that they'll get a return on their investment, right? That's what they want. They want a return on their investment. And so it's not just that it raises rents, it also lowers the quality. Landlords in these rent-controlled apartments are less likely to spend money on maintenance because they can't recoup their investment. And so they go into deterioration. I remember there was a World Series back in, what was it, the 70s or 80s, where they were doing a stadium shot and you could see a fire from an apartment building that was set by a landlord. This was going, I think it was in the 70s, it was going on frequently in New York because landlords were setting fire to their rent-controlled apartments for the insurance money because they were losing money hand over fist. And so this is a problem, right? So if you want to lower rents, the only economically sound way to do that is to increase the supply. And the only economically sound way to increase the supply is to leave it to the market, right? Rent control tries to set prices. And when you set prices at below market rates, it creates shortages, right? This is econ 101. You're an econ professor. You would teach this in the freshman level class, would you not? Right. This is common knowledge in economics, but people still think there's an exception to this in rent. And all of the evidence shows that that's not the case. Argentina recently lowered rents by abolishing rent controls. Rents have fallen.
Yeah, that
in
actually
Argentina
happened over the last year
under Milei. Yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing. So, I mean, the thing is, you can restrict the supply of housing and the price is going to go up. So rent control is one way of doing it. CEQA lawsuits against prospective developers are another way of doing it. New zoning requirements are another way of doing it. All these things in California in particular have the effect of restricting growth. And they all invoke something that seems good on the surface. You know, you want to protect the environment. You want to protect history. You want to protect the zucchini so it can have enough light. you want to keep rents down. All these, you know, things that you want to preserve the character of your neighborhood. These all my heartstrings are, you know, pinging at every point. But the cumulative effect of this is to drastically curtail the supply of residential housing in California. And the effect of that is to drive the price way up and to throw people on the streets.
Yeah. And you'll see this in surveys. People will consistently say they support more housing in California, but then they'll oppose it in their neighborhood or something like this. And it's like, well, everybody in every neighborhood's doing this. So it has a collective effect.
Yeah,
right? You think,
yeah,
we just don't want it here. Well, where then? Right? Because they don't want it there. It's got to go somewhere.
And yeah. Your moral point a little while ago on this was very interesting to me, that this resistance to residential development comes from NIMBYs. It comes from people who already have their stake. They've already got their piece, their whatever. And so they're represented in these efforts to stop development, but prospective buyers and prospective renters are systemically eliminated from representation in these battles. The NIMBYs have their stuff. The prospective renters, the prospective buyers, have no voice and no presence in the discussion. That's a moral argument, not just an economic argument.
Yeah, in fact, I didn't say this in the report, but I have said this before, is if you want to understand democratic socialism, look at NIMBYism in California. Yeah. It is literally democratic socialism. It is the product of the democratization of city planning, right? And it's socialist in the fact that it's people saying what you can do with your private property, right? We put your property, Graham, subject to the democracy of everybody who lives in
right.
Oakland or wherever, right? And that's democratic socialism, and it's a disaster. But it's literally the best manifestation of that, the most accurate manifestation of that I think we have in the United States.
Yeah, that's pretty remarkable, Chris. Let's talk for our last few minutes here about solutions, because toward the end of your report, which is very much worth reading, and it's just to remind our friends, it can be found on our website, independent.org, where we have a series of these reports called California Golden Fleece Awards, where we award this ironic honor to some bad player, in this case, a bunch of NIMBY actors. But in this report, like other ones that you have superintended, there are solutions proposed. So is there a way out of this? I mean, it sounds like it's going to be tough because so many Californians are of two minds and they don't want to reconcile the two sides of their own mind. But what could be done to get out of this tangle?
Well, the first thing I talk about in the report as far as solutions is just property rights enforcement, individual private property rights. And this was actually parallels a change that took place in the 19th century. So in the early 19th century, before the Jacksonians, we were still kind of governed by property law that dates back, that, you know, developed out of the medieval era in Europe. And this would be, I mentioned like the rule of ancient lights, which is similar to the zucchini lady situation, where it's your neighbor could block you from building a house if that house would block the light that would go through one of their windows, right? And you know, William Blackstone, the famed English jurist, said it's up to the neighbor to find some less offensive thing to do with their property, right? And so this was the rule up until the Jacksonians.
So this was kind of a medieval doctrine that we're talking about from ages past.
Yeah, it's Morton Horowitz. I refer to it as medieval. Morton Horowitz refers to it as early modern law, but it developed out of medieval law and was kind of like put in the books by Blackstone in the early modern period. But a lot of this stuff traces back to the feudal era in Europe. So I would consider it medieval law. And the idea was that not that you didn't have property rights, but that property rights took priority of the first comers, like the people that lived there first in time, first in right. They had a Latin phrase that translated to first in time, first in right. And that was the juridical principle that they used in these cases. And in the Jacksonian era, there was a revolt against this practice in favor of economic development, in which they replaced this old rule with an idea of equal rights and individual property rights, right? It was an egalitarian move. That's what it was considered. It was very egalitarian. It was equal rights for property owners, which means you as my neighbor don't have the right to tell me what to do with my property. We have equal rights with what we can do with our property, and that's you don't get to tell me what I can do, right? And that led to this incredible boom in development, and it came through the courts primarily. Like, this was not a statutory change, and a lot of NIMBYism goes through the courts as well. So I think on the one hand, the courts can actually start enforcing property rights. This can be a legal cultural change that manifests in
So that's
in
a solution to reinvigorate property rights.
That's the foundational solution, right? Because all of this NIMBY activism is a violation of individual property rights. And the way I point it is, it's property rights. You can have private property ownership in California, but private property rights are negated by these processes.
Right.
And so that's very important. But beyond that, what you want to do is you want to liberalize zoning policies. Remember, in the 80s, the NIMBYism manifested through zoning regulations and ballot measures primarily. So you want to eliminate parking requirements, building height restrictions, minimum lot sizes, floor area square footage ratio requirements, things like this. You want to end single family zoning, all of these things, or just abolish zoning entirely. Houston's never had it, and they're below the national average for housing costs, despite being the fifth largest city, right? So abolishing zoning should be part of the conversation now. Permit reform is a big one, especially in places like San Francisco. Discretionary permits are the justification for CEQA. Discretionary permits, yes. And they are a basis that NIMBYs can contest. They can appeal permits, challenge permits. In San Francisco, every time they challenge a permit, somebody challenges a permit, the city is obligated to hold a public hearing over that challenge. At the developer's expense, right? So permit reform for a system of by right or ministerial permits. I frequently talk about our colleague Lawrence McKillen's proposed right to build amendment that would solve this problem.
I love that one.
I talk about it every chance I get because I think it's a wonderful solution that also has parallels in the 19th century with Jacksonian era reforms that led to greater economic development. And then repealing CEQA. And I think it does just need to be repealed. It doesn't do any good. It's used primarily by people that have no interest in preserving the environment. The most common pretext or the most common thing CEQA is used to block is infill housing. Infill housing would be housing in empty city blocks in urban areas that increase density. This is actually part of the state's environmental plan is to build infill housing because it's allowing density in the city so that you don't have to encroach further into the countryside. But the vast majority of CEQA lawsuits target infill housing. So just abolish CEQA. It's not used to protect the environment. It's just used to block housing. And in doing so, it actually exacerbates environmental problem. It exacerbates urban sprawl. That exacerbates traffic pollution from people having to commute to and from work because of urban sprawl, right? So CEQA is actually working completely counter to its intended purpose. So just throw it out.
So don't you care about the environment, Chris?
I care about the environment to throw out a law that's harming it.
There you go. That's the right answer. So really, what Californians are facing, and others around the country can take a lesson from this, I think, where the similar errors are being made, but we face a choice, as you say, toward the end of your report, between reform or ruin. I might like say the ruin part is just like we seem to have created a kind of fossilized aristocratic gridlock, and the aristocrats have theirs, but there are millions of people who would like to be able to afford to live in California who are stuck here, people at the middle and at the bottom especially, who can't afford to live here, who can't sustain themselves, but they can't afford to leave either if they're poor. Only the middle class can afford to leave. So aristocratic gridlock is really a form of ruin. But we could choose reform. I think that's your point.
Yeah, and the comparison I make at the end of that you're referring to is what I call, there's two ways to lower housing costs, what I call the Houston model and the Detroit model. Houston lowers housing costs by having light housing regulation, no zoning policies, modest building regulations. It takes 10 days or less to get a permit there. It's very, very easy to build there. And so the population has grown, but housing in the fifth largest city has stayed below the national average consistently, even as the population has ballooned. And in fact, you could point at other Texas cities. Austin's done so much to build more housing through liberalized zoning laws that they've actually reduced rents by 20%, right?
Wow.
So I should call it the Texas model.
Yeah.
Because Texas
reduced
is becoming
rents
a leader
by 20%.
Austin, and that's the bluest city in Texas,
yeah,
by the way, right?
That's
a very Democrat city, but they liberalized zoning policies and dramatically reduced rents, despite significant population growth. A lot of techies are moving to Austin. It's like the new San Francisco, or poised to become it. The other model for reducing housing costs is what I call the Detroit model, and the Detroit lowered housing costs not by building more housing, but by losing half its population after the 2008 crisis and then the 2013 bankruptcy of the city. The population fled Detroit in droves, so that the city has lost half its population since 2008.
Yeah. If you drive through it, there are all these empty lots of like abandoned housing, abandoned property everywhere.
So housing is cheap in Detroit, but that's not the way you want cheap housing, because Detroit is a shadow of what it used to be. It used to be the Motor City. Now it's economically depressed. depressed. It's dilapidated. The businesses are shutting down.
It's emptied out.
So housing is cheap, but you don't want to live there. You know? So, those are the two options, because if California continues going the path it's going, population flight has already happened. 2021 was the first year on record that California lost population. And as housing costs grow up, that's inevitable, because people can't afford to live there. And so you're going to get population flight if you don't get the housing costs under control, and that's going to lead to ruin.
You have given us an incredible tour of this whole problem. Thank you so much, Chris Carlton. I just want to remind people that they can take a look at this wonderful report. It's called How NIMBY Activism Worsens California's Housing Crisis. And it's available at independent.org. On our website. And of course, Chris Carlton has worked hard on this thing. So grateful for all you've done, Chris Carlton, Dr. Christopher Carlton.
Thank you for having me.
Work gets widely read and has a lot of influence.
I hope so as well, because if it moves the needle at all to lowering housing costs, then that's a victory.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, people like me, I'm a seventh generation Californian. I love California. I want California to get out of the morass it's in, rather than to dig deeper. And you show part of the way in that direction. So thanks so much. Thank you for all of our friends who've joined us on Independent Conversations here at Independent Institute in Oakland. I invite you to join us next time as we discuss the issues of the day on Independent Conversations. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.